Thank you for explaining that. And it sounds as though, well, firstly, to sort of take our listeners back a little bit, we did an interview prior to the conclusion of the Disability Royal Commission to talk about what restrictive practices are. And then your colleague, also Dr. Claire Spivakovsky, joined us later in the year. So, in terms of this understanding of how restrictive practices are applied, used against disabled people, maybe if we could, talk a little bit about in the setting of mental health facilities itself and how, like you said, a lot of the framing of therapeutic interventions is that they're for the benefit of people with disability, when really I think activists are trying to put forward the message that harm is being done to disabled people, and then they're not necessarily in a position to put forward complaints or have self-advocacy depending on the nature of their disability. So I myself only recently realized that I've had restrictive practices like used against me. And I was in hospital as a young person. I was experiencing psychotic symptoms at the age of 14, and then sorry, 15, and was hospitalized for the first time in my grade 11 year. And I remember I actually didn't ever like swallowing medication. And so that was one of the main reasons why I said to the nurses and doctors, I don't want to take any medication, partly because I believed that I wasn't unwell and partly because I found taking medication unpleasant. And they said to me, if you don't take your medication, you're going to have a needle. We're going to have security come in here and hold you down. And and obviously that scared me. And so I ended up taking the medication. And that's just one example. I think that I guess when you're in a setting like that, you suddenly become very powerless. And do you realize that it feels as though if you don't comply with the instructions of the people who have more power than you, then they can do things to you that you don't want. What is the kind of would you say that there is this kind of idea that doctors and nurses were able to use these sort of restrictive practices and not necessarily have any accountability for when it goes wrong, because it can go really wrong, I guess, because people want to protect themselves, and so there's a lot of violence that would go on in these settings from security and things people can asphyxiate, when we know this from other activist movements where particularly deaths in custody, where people are laid in prone positions and weight is put on their back or neck. So I just wanted to, I guess tie that into the kind of positions that disabled people are being put in terms of like positionality of powerlessness. And what were the recommendations of the commission in terms of how to prevent injustice and abuse of power going on in these settings?
Yes. So thanks for sharing that, Belle. And I'm sorry that that was your experience. I guess as a first thing to note is that the point that you made at the start, which is that you only recently realized that your experience could constitute a use of restrictive practice. And I think that's a really important reminder that there's these forms of violence that are not widely understood as such by society. As you mentioned, that it's often seen that people that restrictive practice, so this is kind of non-consensual interventions that limit people's movement or rights that are seen to be a necessary response to someone's behavior. And so restrictive practices are often seen by the medical profession, by law, by policy, as being necessary to intervene in someone's behavior for their own safety or for the safety of others, or sometimes even for the protection of property. But the broader community might not even know what restrictive practices are because it's such a specialized term. It's kind of a term of art that's only used in the context of disabled people. And so what we might have other names for in the broader community might be, restraining someone or locking them up or assault and so on. We don't use those words when we're talking about that in the context of people with disability, when it's done by professionals or institutional staff. We use this term restrictive practice. And so already we are erasing through the words we use the understanding of these as acts of violence or understanding of these as possibly experiences that are shared by others in the broader community and are known by others in the broader community as acts of violence. And on the kind of other extreme, moving from the broader community to the individuals who are subjected to them, again, people might not actually always be aware that what they have experienced is restrictive practice and in turn is a form of violence because, as you mentioned, the power dynamics in institutional spaces such as mental health facilities, are structured in a way that compliance is expected from people who are under mental health orders, and that those in positions of authority, such as nurses or doctors and so on, are assumed to always be acting in the best interest or to be acting in a way that is inherently non-violent because they're seen as being associated with medicine and therapy and health and so on. And additionally, it's not the case that people are always taught about their rights in mental health facilities and other institutional spaces, where specifically in those spaces or in their broader lives, some people who are in mental health facilities might be experiencing marginalization and violence in their broader lives, and so not be able to identify when they've experienced violence or injustice.